www.eatchew.com. And he's written several books such as Eat, Chew, Live, and Diabetes, The Real Cause and the Right Cure. And we will be joining him shortly. First, I wanted to let you know, listeners, thank you so much for listening to The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. I was at the Florida Herbal Conference about a week ago, and I was amazed at how many people came up and said, you know, we listen to your podcast, and they're from all over the country. We get emails and Facebook posts every single day from people who are listeners, and we'd love to hear from you. And we do send out a newsletter. To sign up for the newsletter, you just have to go to naturalnurse.com, go to the very bottom of the page, and just put in your email, nothing else, where it says sign up for newsletter. Then you will get an email, and you have to approve it. Go, yep, I did want to join the newsletter. You have to do that, or they won't put you on because you have, you know, it's like no spam. Also, if you ever want to jump off, you just send a very simple off and you're gone. So it's not a big process. And we only send out a newsletter, I would say less than once a month. Mostly we let you know about the very many, many classes and workshops we have online almost daily, as well as our thousands of podcasts that are available for you to listen to anytime for free. And they're searchable by topic name or guest name. So if you wanted to know about heart health, let's say, you could put that in and you'll get lots and lots of different doctors discussing it. Or if you wanted to know about diabetes, the real cause and the right cure, we'll be talking to our guest today about that. And that will be archived as well as live today. But some of the up-and-coming classes we have that are exciting that you can find at any time by going to naturalnurse.com and then just click on classes. So we have going on now our Natural Nurse Herbal Certification course. And this class was designed for anyone. Health professionals who take this class get CEUs. And if you take the full course, it's 18 CEUs. We had the first live class a month ago, but that is archived. And then we have ongoing live sessions, but you can join in any time until June and take all the past live sessions on the archive. Do the homework if you want to get 18 CEUs. Now, CEUs, of course, are for people who have licenses like licensed nurses, nurse practitioners, midwives, massage therapists, acupuncturists, nutritionists such as RDs, and clinical nutritionists, you will get CEUs. But you can also take the class just because you want to know about such things as herbs, how to decide which herbs you want. What about a little bit of botany and botanical nomenclature if you're out in the field doing wildcrafting, or using herbs for yourself and your family? How to put together the right kind of protocol. So you don't have to be a health professional, but if you are, you get CEUs. And then we have a class, part of the series, which is feeling the consciousness of plants. The fact that there is so much scientific validation in terms of our ability to communicate truly with plants. We even have receptor sites on our cells that allow us to have interspecies communication with other kinds of animals other than humans, as well as plants. So all of that and more, plus CE credits if you want it, by taking the Natural Nurse Herbal Certification course. And links to sign up are right there. Some people are interested in becoming an RD. RDs can also take the class, an RH. An RH is a registered herbalist, and that you can actually use this class towards getting as well. An RH is a powerful certification showing anyone that you know a lot in terms of herbal medicine. So if you wanted to share with people how they should use, what they should use, how you put together a protocol and why, that would be a good reason to take this class as well. We also have lots of on-ground classes coming up. Dr. Zamperone just finished taking our group to Jamaica for our yearly Echo Tours for Cures to Jamaica. You can go online at Facebook to see Echo Tours for Cures, or on YouTube. We have lots of videos about our last trip, which was just last week. But people are already signing up because it always closes out for next year. So we have that ongoingly. We also have the wild edible and medicinal herb identification walks coming up, several of them, because we're barreling towards June, and that's when this starts. We have June 10th at Restoration Farm in Bethpage in New York. We also have a spring Chinatown herb walk, which is in New York City. And that's also in June. And then we have a very famous herbal medicine making workshop at Restoration Farm. And that's in July, where we all go out in the field, gather wild edible medicinal plants, and the whole group makes your own medicine to take it home. So that's usually sold out. That's, you know, a full day in the field. Plus then we're in a kind of a barn where we cook to make salve, we make extracts, we learn how to strip bark off plants to use it correctly. And so lots and lots and lots of classes are coming up, and you can join us for whichever ones you want. Just go to naturalnurse.com and then look at classes. You can also get all our, look under media to radio shows for links to our archives, hundreds of them for past shows. And today we're going to bring on board Dr. John. And Dr. John is a medical doctor who practiced medicine as a pediatrician and allergist for more than 30 years. And he holds many mainstream certifications, such as from the American Board of Pediatrics, the American Board of Allergy and Immunology, and the Canadian Board of Pediatrics. And is, as of now, Dr. John considers himself a patient advocate, trying to empower people with new scientific insights and complementary approaches to things like obesity, type 2 diabetes, and surviving cancer. And he has written many books. You can find them all at drjohnonhealth.com. So thank you so much for joining us today, Dr. John.
Ms. Kami, I thank you for having me, and I thank our listeners.
Let's go back in time to when you were a child. Where did you grow up, and what inspired you to become a physician?
I grew up in India, and from childhood, I was curious about things, everything in general. In school, I got interested in science, and I wanted to know how things happen. And that got me interested in medical field, because there what interested me most was the physiology. How does heart work? How do you exchange oxygen for carbon dioxide? And more importantly, I had this question. We cannot predict when we are going to be hungry. How does the brain know? You know, it is unpredictable. The same way, we don't always eat the same volume of food to feel satisfied. Why? These curiosities led me to go into the medical textbooks and find out answers. And when I could not find answers in the medical textbooks, I came up with my own, so to speak.
You mean your own theories about how this all worked together?
Exactly.
And then you have certifications both in the U.S. and Canada. Did you also spend part of your life in Canada?
After graduation from a medical school in India, I went to Scotland. There I did internship. And then in the year 1970, I came to the United States as a pediatric resident, Washington, D.C., D.C. General Hospital. Then I went to Phoenix, Arizona. I went to Canada. I went to Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Finally, I settled in Texas and practiced for between 25 and 30 years. When I retired, I got more time to concentrate on my questions that was lingering in the back of my mind. And that is when I started to do the research and write it down, what I found and what I thought were the real answers.
Well, that's why it says on your website, scientific insights.
Yes.
And complementary approaches. What do you mean by complementary?
You see, most of us, almost all allopathic practitioners are taught there is a cure. You can just put a medication or treat and everything with medication. Otherwise, they don't know what to do. Anytime if you want to prevent an illness, you need to know the root cause of how it starts or at least how it spreads. Take the COVID, for example. We know it is a coronavirus. It is naturally present in bats. How does it travel and infect a human? Because the attachment protein, the spike protein in a bat cannot attach itself to a human cell receptor. So it needs an intermediary animal. And now they suspect it may be a raccoon dog that got infected, came to the Wuhan market in China, and it exploded all over the world. So if we know that, then we can take preventive measures. So during my practice, I found a number of people with type 2 diabetes on insulin, keeping the A1C below 7, and still having complications of type 2 diabetes. For example, 50% of them will get kidney damage. 25% of them will get eye damage, going blind. 2.5% will get amputations of legs and toes. And 25% on top of that will experience symptoms of hypoglycemia.
So you're talking about people who are already diagnosed with diabetes often go down that road. And I have to say, I know so many people, just of course, I'm a nurse and I work in health, but that amputation is not that unusual, which is terrible.
Yes. So my question was, how does the blood sugar go up in the first place? And this is a very fascinating story for most people don't understand this. The originally, diabetes was diagnosed by two ancient healers in India when they observed a child after urinating on the earth outside. They observed ants coming to the urine, the site of urination of that particular child, and they were curious, and they actually tasted the urine of that child and found it to be sweet. And that sweetness is what attracted the ants. Later on, of course, it was diagnosed as type 1 diabetes, where the pancreas does not produce insulin. For those who do not know what insulin does, insulin is just a messenger. After a meal, when blood sugar goes up, it stimulates your pancreas to release insulin. Insulin does not go into a cell. It goes outside the cell and rings the doorbell, so to speak.
It rings the doorbell. I like that analogy.
Yeah. When somebody rings the doorbell on your apartment or your house, you know there is somebody out there, and you have the option of letting that person in or not. Nowadays, with the cameras, you can even see exactly who it is. The same way with the cell, every cell can use glucose. But glucose, when it comes to the outside of the cell, there is no doorbell to ring. That is the job of insulin. So if there is no insulin, glucose will accumulate in the blood, but the cells are starving inside because they cannot produce energy by getting insulin, breaking down insulin. So these children used to die by age 10. 100 years ago, in 1921, two researchers in Canada discovered insulin, and they started treating children with insulin. And sure enough, their lifespan improved, their quality of life improved. In the United States, in Boston, Dr. Elliot Joslin treated the maximum number of type 1 diabetics, and he was so amazed by the progress they made, he trained a number of certified nurses to go out and give everybody with high blood sugar insulin. And then his own relative was given insulin, her blood sugar went down, and he was sure this is a same disease, but starting at a later age group. So he called it adult onset diabetes. Now, something interesting happened. A test came on board to measure the level of insulin in the blood, and they found not enough insulin or practically no insulin in type 1 diabetics, whereas plenty of insulin in people with type 2 diabetes, and they could not explain it why. So at the same time, there was first reports of penicillin-resistant bacteria. So Dr. William Falter in 1940 suggested that perhaps the same thing is happening in adult diabetics. Their cells are not responding to insulin. So that became the theory called insulin resistance theory of type 2 diabetes.
Right, not that there's not enough insulin around, which does happen in what's called type 1 diabetes, that it's actually right. Genetic and they don't have enough insulin. But one thing is, therefore, would you say that type 2 diabetes, which you're talking about, may be linked to the insulin resistance, one of the many factors that's important there. Really, what's good about it is it means it's more controllable, because the genetic one, that person has less control over.
Exactly. You got that right, Dr. Kami. If insulin is not a problem, then what is it? Why does the blood sugar go up? So what I was thinking was, in 60 years ago, we had the Green Revolution. There's plenty, every government in the body and the world subsidized grain farming. And the percentage of energy that if a person takes from food, when he or she eats food, the percentage of energy coming from complex carbohydrate was less than 35% before the Green Revolution. Now it is 50 to 70%. When is the last?
Okay, that's important. I want to talk about that again. You're saying that before this like massive amount of money was dumped into what you're calling the grain revolution. So what kind of grains are you talking about there?
At that time, people ate mainly wild corn, and some people collected very painstakingly like quinoa. And it is a whole day process.
Wait, when you're talking about quinoa,
yeah,
I don't. In the U.S., were they growing quinoa? Was that something that was grown? Because I eat quinoa all the time. It's a wonderful high protein, high fat grain. But it wasn't ever popular in the U.S., was it?
No, it was not. It was. We bought wheat here, and then wild corn, of course, the Native Americans. Coming to that. Look at the history of Native Americans. When they were brought to the reservations in the year 1900, they had complete physical examination. And you know what? They practically had no type 2 diabetes, none. They discovered all the hospitalizations, but it was not for type 2 diabetes. Now, adults in Arizona, the Pima Indians, 50% of them over age 30 are diabetic, 50. What happened? In their natural habitat, they moved from one food source to another. They ate everything, fruits, nuts, yams, animals, eggs, fish. Whereas in the reservation, their primary source of food energy was grains and grain-based foods. So, My suggestion is, if you don't put a glucose-releasing food in your mouth, blood sugar cannot go up. Just simple as it's as natural as can be, as you have been advocating, Ms. Cammy, let us go by natural way. Nature never intended grains for humans. Otherwise, we would have had the ability to pick it up and digest the chaff. We don't have it. So the milling and the industrial revolution made it possible to produce so many varieties of grain flours, and that is the root cause of type 2 diabetes with elevation of blood sugar. So if you reverse that, you can reverse diabetes without medications.
Well, particularly type 2.
We are talking about type 2. Type 1, yes, you need, in type 1, insulin is a lifesaver. In type 2, in my opinion, it is simply a troublemaker.
I totally agree. But I have noticed over discussing the same thing with many, you know, thousands of patients over the years, that one thing is some of them, even if they had type 2, they were thinking about, like, it's not their fault. It has to do with their genes. And I would say in most cases, that's not true. Even if it's something that occurs in a family, I'm thinking of this one family, they were Italian, they all had diabetes, they were all overweight, but they all ate the same way, which was tons of pasta and bread at every meal. You know, so recognizing that connection that makes it not so much genetic means that you can take control and change it rather than have a nice excuse and just go, it's genetic.
That is an excellent a way to explain that. Let me put it this way. If it is fundamentally genetic, why did it not start from childhood? We have the same gene from birth. So that does not make sense. On the other hand, as you just explained very nicely, it is familiar, the same environment. Everybody eats the same thing. And that is what is causing the type 2 diabetic epidemic all over the world. Everywhere it is happening, whether it is. Now, there is a fundamental question here, which is very alarming. That is, in the United States, 85% of people with type 2 diabetes are obese. Whereas, you know, in India, 60% of type 2 diabetics are not obese, either normal weight or slightly overweight. Western medicine has no explanation why a lean person develops diabetes. They say somehow he develops insulin resistance. There is no test for the degree of insulin resistance. Have you ever heard of a test saying, oh, my insulin resistance is this number or that number? No. Why?
Oh, you're right. You know what? So you're saying if you go to a doctor, although they could measure your blood sugar and they could measure your insulin level, so how do you as a physician or some other physician come to the diagnosis of insulin resistance if there's no actual test for it?
It is just a matter of explanation. So they explain it away. And even more alarming is the fact that we have 200 different types of cells in the body. And the endocrinologist picked only three types of cells to be resistant: muscles, liver, and fat. Why? Nobody knows. There is no clear explanation why they picked on these three types of cells. And these cells, why these cells picked one out of 50 hormones in the body, specifically insulin, to resist? Why? There's no explanation. So it is a matter of convenience because they can explain the laboratory findings based on this. Now think about it. A young lady who is pregnant, at the end of second trimester, she's diagnosed with gestational diabetes. She never had diabetes before. There is no family history of diabetes. And after delivery, few days, couple of weeks, her diabetes goes away.
So you're talking about pregnancy diabetes, which seems to be transitional.
Correct. How can he have temporary insulin resistance? What is the mechanism? They claim, the endocrinologist came, it is the same illness as everyday type 2 diabetes without any test. How does these ladies develop insulin resistance lasting for a few months and he's gone?
What is the theory about that?
I'm sorry?
So why is it? That's a good question.
Yes. So my concept is the genes, you mentioned genes. Genes give you the potential. It is not your fate. It gives you, for example, women who inherit breast cancer genes, for every action in the cell, a gene has to be activated. A gene is responsible. However, we get two copies of the same gene, one from the father, one from the mother. See, if one copy, for example, the breast cancer gene inherited from the mother is defective, is mutated, the father's gene will take over. Yes, men also have genes for breast development. This is why when the woman develops breast, it does not become cancerous. Only later on, if the father's gene is also mutated, she will develop cancer. In other words, she has more susceptibility for cancer compared to one with both genes normal. So this way, when we are born, we inherit a gene, a capacity to store fat in the body. How much is your fat storage capacity? When you become pregnant, everybody is telling you, eat this food. This is good for the baby's brain. This is good for the baby's bone, height, complexion. And the girl eats and eats. And if she fills up the fat storage capacity, let us say her capacity is 20 pounds and she gained 30 pounds of weight, that excess weight will stay in the blood as glucose, because as we mentioned earlier, most of the energy is now coming from grains, which when digested, release massive amount of glucose. The liver converts most of the glucose into fat, but if the fat storage capacity is full, glucose will stay in the blood. Whether you are a lean person or whether you are pregnant, the same thing can happen. On the other hand, suppose you have inherited a huge fat storage capacity. Sometimes you see people who weigh 200, 300 pounds with normal blood sugar. Why? Because they can store the fat safely away from the blood because they have large storage capacity. Not unlike refrigerators, which has different storage capacities, the same thing.
So that's why it's different with different people.
Exactly. So you can run, see, in the family, if you eat the same amount of food, then you have more chance, almost everybody will have a chance of developing type 2 diabetes, as you correctly mentioned earlier. Whereas it also depends on, some members may escape that because they have a larger fat storage capacity or smaller, depending on the individual genetic makeup.
Well, that is interesting information. And we're going to go to a little break here so we can hear a natural medicine chest right here on Progressive Radio Voices, and you can find us on prn.live, and this is Ellen Kamai, the Natural Nurse. Find all kinds of information and communicate with us at naturalnurse.com or Facebook, The Natural Nurse, or Instagram, all those things. I like saying the website, naturalnurse.com, and you can go there and then link to all those other things as well. And today we're so happy to have as our guest Dr. John Pudhalil, and we'll be talking with him more. We'll be right back after the Natural Medicine Chest right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. Hopefully you enjoyed The Natural Medicine Chest. Please visit us at naturalnurse.com. We'd love to hear from you. What topics would you like us to cover? Because we have about 1,000 shows that you can listen to already. You can find them at naturalnurse.com under media and radio shows. And of course, these are also podcasts. And you can hear our podcast on every podcast venue, anyone that you go to. Someone just asked us if we were on Apple Podcasts. So I looked it up. And sure enough, The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z, you can get it on Apple Podcasts and all kinds of other podcast arenas. And today, we're so happy to have as our guest, Dr. John, and you can find him at his website, drjohnonhealth.com. And it's a great website, Dr. John, where you have all kinds of information and also featuring your books. We talked a lot about your diabetes book and the fact that there is a real cause and there is a right cure, which you started to talk to us about in terms of, really, I would say, I 100% do not eat ever what I would call ultra-processed food. And that's not hard to do. Like if someone were to look in my refrigerator, there's nothing in a package. There's nothing with a paragraph. There's just pieces of food in there. Of course, I'm fortunate enough to have the funds and also the availability to get organic food. So I take that step. But even if you can't do organic food, you could get a cabbage and, you know, other things that are a whole piece of food instead of something that is packaged and processed and not even food at all. I think so much of what you're saying, Dr. John, is that if people are eating all kinds of packaged processed food all day, that is one of the most likely things to lead to various illnesses, including diabetes.
I absolutely agree with you 100%. Yes. The grains, grain production on the one hand and the Industrial Revolution on the other hand made it possible to package foods, easy availability, affordability, and that is what caused the intake of grain-based glucose to so high a level as to cause obesity and diabetes. So you ask me, what should I tell the people? Yes, my advice will be cut down the amount of grain-based foods to one half of what you are eating right now on a daily basis. That is the simplest step you can take to reduce the blood sugar level. Just cut down to one half.
So when you say grains, a lot of that is wheat. What about things like brown rice? Or are you talking about all grain?
All grains. Brown, if you take 100 grams of refined grain, it is 80 grams of glucose. If you take 100 grams of whole grain, it is 77 grams of glucose.
A little less. Yeah.
Practically, there is not that much difference whether it is whole grain, brown grain, parboiled grain. It makes not much difference. However, the quantity, the total amount of glucose, incoming glucose after each meal, that is what is causing the problem. Cut that down. You don't need insulin, especially if you're a type 2 diabetic. Now, in addition to that, in order to keep your body strong, just like you mentioned, you need a variety of foods as natural as possible if you can afford it. If you cannot, then you need micronutrients. That is where the herbs and spices come in. You don't eat every plant. You don't enjoy it. But why do we enjoy certain herbs? Because they contain nutrients, micronutrients your body, your brain has identified as useful. For example, you won't enjoy eating sawdust or hay. And, you know, the horses and animals enjoy eating hay. Why can't we? Because there are nutrients available to them from hay, whereas herbs and spices provide micronutrients for humans. People have been using it for thousands of years. Why? Because they found it enjoyable. And why do you enjoy it? Because the brain senses there is a nutrient in there that is useful. That is how. So go back to nature. Eat as many of, I suggest people eat at least three different varieties of vegetable a day. Three different fruits a day.
You say three vegetables. Well, the USDA says 9 servings of vegetables a day.
I'm not talking about servings. I'm talking about variety.
Okay.
And three different varieties of fruits, three different varieties of nuts a day. So you get a number of different nutrients your body needs to be healthy and your immune system to be strong.
Well, one thing, these new monitors for people with insulin, where they actually have something sort of under their skin, I know diabetics who are telling me that is very useful because they get immediate feedback on their phone about what each thing they are eating and even doing in terms of stress-related events and how that affects their blood sugar, and they get immediate feedback.
You know, that is a very interesting question. I'm glad you asked. There are two points I want to make. One is there is no evidence, there is no studies to show those who measure blood glucose level 2, 3, 4 times a day will have less complications in the long term compared to those who don't. There is no study. Secondly, there is no other long-term illnesses, chronic illnesses, where you are asked to measure any test, any measurement multiple times a day. Do you measure blood sugar, blood pressure 5 times a day? Do you measure cholesterol level? Do you measure triglyceride level? Why glucose? And what does you do with it? It only creates more anxiety than solving a problem. Yes, it makes the gadget manufacturers rich, and it makes you feel, oh, you are in control. But yes, it can be useful if you know which food, how much, is responsible for your blood sugar elevation, and you cut it down. Or for that, all you need to know is one test. You don't have to keep testing 5 times a day. On the other hand, each time you don't feel well, you get nervous. Oh, it could be because my blood sugar. The anxiety adds to your problem. And I have not seen a study that shows that those who continuously monitor blood glucose level experience less complications of type 2 diabetes. Show me a study.
Okay, so you feel that that's over-testing and maybe over-anxiety and being over-invested in the disease instead of just changing your diet, and that's going to get rid of it for so many people.
Exactly. You have to take action. Before you became a diabetic, you ate food. You were fine. You did not have high blood sugar. So what changed? What happens is the amount of energy that we spend every day, there is a drop after age 35. But by that time, you are used to a certain level of food intake. When you are hungry, you put the same volume of food on the plate. And once you put it on the plate, you don't want to waste it. You eat it. But your energy expenditure goes down. How many 45, 50-year-old professional athletes do you see out there? You cannot produce the same amount of muscle energy because your hormone levels go down. So if you do not reduce the quantity of food energy intake corresponding to the reduced expenditure, you have a problem. This is what happens around age 35, then again more, again around age 55, and every decade, your energy expenditure level goes down. But your food intake remains the same or may even go up because now you are comfortable, you can afford it, you eat, and you fill up your fat storage capacity, glucose stays in the blood, you become a diabetic. Well, if you cut down the intake, That's all it takes.
Well, that's such good advice. And stand by, Dr. John. We're going to allow our station, Progressive Radio Network, to have some time to let you know about other great shows that are here. And you can always hear us also, The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. And you can visit us at naturalnurse.com. Stand by. We'll be right back with more right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. And welcome back once again, right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z on Progressive Radio Network, PRN.LIVE. You can always find us at naturalnurse.com. And we've been having a really interesting conversation today with physician Dr. John Puthalil. And you can find him at drjohnonhealth.com. He's written many fascinating books, and his newest book is called Your Health is at Risk, How to Navigate Information Chaos to Prevent Lifestyle Diseases. We don't have that long, but let's talk about what do you mean by information chaos, Dr. John?
Type 2 diabetes, we have been discussing, is an excellent example. Doctors will tell you that you became a diabetic because you are insulin resistant. Now, think about it. If you are resistant to an antibiotic, will the doctor give you the same antibiotic on a routine basis? No. Yet, on the one hand, endocrinologists tell you you became a type 2 diabetic because your body became resistant to insulin. And what does the doctor give you? Insulin. How does that make sense? And then there are people who will give you advice on how to treat diabetes. Do this, do that, take this, take that. How do you know which one to believe? I'm not asking everybody to believe what I am saying. What I'm asking is you need to ask questions. Ask your diabetologist, if I am resistant to insulin, why are you giving me insulin? If I keep the blood sugar level down, A1C below 7, can I escape complications of type 2 diabetes? If I'm still having complications, what is the reason? The same with COVID, the same with cancer. So heart disease, everybody has heard about good cholesterol, bad cholesterol. What does good cholesterol do? There is no evidence. Good cholesterol is good for anything. So we need to have answers. That is why, how do you navigate all this information with the internet, with the social media? You get so much information. As you mentioned, there are so many thousands of podcasts. Whom do you believe? How do you know?
There are also these people on now who I find very scary. They're called influencers, and they're usually young women, you know, and they're very cute, but they actually say things as if they know what they're talking about, and they do not have a clue. They never studied one day of herbal medicine even, or anatomy and physiology, or all the things that you've looked into for 40 or 50 years plus practice with patients as a physician. And people do something called follow them, and they follow their advice, which is completely misinformed.
Exactly. That is exactly what, people like us, we have been in the business for so long, we know what is happening, but in a way we feel helpless. Because so many young people, they want instant information, instant cure, do this, do that, take a tablet. But why don't we go back to nature? Nature has made it possible. Humans can live healthy anywhere on the planet. Why? There are natural nutrients available locally. We'll go back to nature. Eat what you can, eat like a toddler, eat when you're hungry. Look at the enjoyment of eating. That first bite of food tastes so good. But as you eat, the enjoyment diminishes. That is your brain's way of telling you, you don't need any more of that food.
So also, you have a book about chewing. You know, just like everybody's grandmother always told them to do, regardless of what their tradition is. Why did you write an entire book about chewing?
The idea is, if you look at nature, from which adult humans can get nutrients from, is there anything there that you can get nutrients from without chewing? Unless you take honey, everything needs chewing. Why? In the ancient days, before fire was invented, people used to spend 10 to 11 hours a day eating food, primarily to chew. Then, of course, cooking made it easier. So what happens? When you chew, the nutrients are released at a rate where your receptors, the taste buds and the smell receptors, can pick them up and inform the brain what nutrients are coming in. If you blend the food and puree the food, you are essentially drinking. And all you have to do is, when you are thirsty, pour the water down the throat, and you will drink more, but you won't feel satisfied. Your thirst won't be quenched until you sip the water. Whereas if you take it by drinking, then you can control the rate of intake on the quantity based on what you need. And the same mechanism is present for every nutrient the human body needs. So if you chew it, take time. As I mentioned earlier, eating is one of the few enjoyments that you can enjoy fully multiple times a day. So everybody enjoys eating. What I'm saying is, enjoy what you eat, each bite of food. Chew it, enjoy it. Then your brain will help you control the quantity. By the same token, if you boil some rice, wheat, can you enjoy that by itself? Most of the time, it is not rice that you enjoy. It is what you add with it. It is not bread that you enjoy. It is what you keep with it as a sandwich. And no, sometimes some people enjoy the saltiness. If you boil any of the grains without salt, it is hard to enjoy them. That means human body cannot get many nutrients just from grains alone. So you're not going to miss any nutrients if you cut down the amount of grain-based foods to one half. But eat what you can chew primarily. That will help you control the quantity.
Well, Dr. John, thank you so much for sharing such great information with us today. And I do like people to know about your website at drjohnonhealth.com. There's a picture of you there, new scientific insights and complementary approaches to prevent obesity. The millions of dollars that's spent on that versus just doing what you're talking about, which is eat less carbs or close to none, chew your food, and of course, you know, get exercise is very important as well.
Yes, and also don't forget the herbs and spices that you add, which makes you want to concentrate on the enjoyment of food. And that also helps you in a very different way, that is to reduce the quantity of salt that we continues to take more and more quantities and get into trouble. The spices will help you reduce the amount of salt needed to prepare foods.
Well, thank you so much for being our guest today. And thank you, listeners, for tuning in once again to The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. I'd like to invite you to visit our website at naturalnurse.com, and you can look around at our classes. You may want to join in, or in fact, all of the books that Dr. Zamperon and I have written as well. So until next time, this is Ellen Kamai, The Natural Nurse, hoping that you stay healthy.